Welcome to Podcetera. Each episode is a journey of discovery as we delve into topics that pique our curiosity and yours. We feature in-depth interviews with fascinating individuals who have extraordinary stories to share.
I'm Renee Lego.
And I'm Joelle Ludovich. And this
is Podcetera. Welcome, Deborah D'Alessandro, to Podcetera. It's so great to have you.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
When was the last time that the three of us were together?
The show ended in 2005 or 2006, but we did have a gathering at Lucky Strike.
Yep.
Bowling
alley. I remember
alley
that, yeah.
In Center City, but I couldn't tell you what year. But we had a lot of crew there from Philly Live.
That was a reunion, mm-hmm. I remember.
I think we're overdue. It's time. It's time to bring the gang back together.
Marina Stamos and Michelle, who you just had on your show, and I'm blanking on her last name.
Gallipoli.
Thank you. It's my brain. Can't say my age because I've always been bad with names. The three of us get together regularly, and we've tried to gather people for... We had a brunch a while ago where we had a couple of folks there, so we have tried. But yeah, there's a lot of folks in Philly, and you know, get you to come to town. From Texas.
It'll happen.
We've invited you, Joelle.
Yes, you have.
You just haven't been able to make
them. Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But that's not what we're here to talk about today. So let's get this episode started. Joelle.
Let's begin by exploring you and your background. You hail from Pennsylvania, having grown up there and pursued your education in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. Could you share with us some insights into your family, upbringing, and educational journey, and how these experiences ultimately brought you to Philadelphia in the 80s, 1980s? So tell us a little bit about yourself.
I was born in a suburb of Pittsburgh, Mount Lebanon. So I lived my first 18 years there. And what brought me to Philly in 1982 was college. And I did my undergraduate at Temple. Temple made, Temple proud, as they say. It was a great experience. Loved Temple for the all kinds of diversity. I remember there were classmates who had served in the Iran-Contra era of U.S., a lot of vets who were using the GI Bill. And I had the good fortune of an excellent public school in the suburb I grew up in. The goal of most of my classmates was to get onto main campus of Penn State. And I was like, so you want to go to a school where everybody's just like you? Have fun. I need to go to a city and get out of Dodge. Because I came out as a lesbian to myself and to others in college, but I knew it's true of me earlier. And I knew I needed to be in a big city. So I love Philly. And I was, as far as my educational journey, I was a poli sci major and a women's studies minor because I thought I wanted to go to law school. And I'm really fortunate that I did not rush into graduate school. Because I did by process of elimination that, like, I don't think that's the right path for me. I worked my first job out of college as a paralegal at Women Against Abuse Legal Center. So then I crossed off, I'm not going to do family law because that will break my heart. And then I served in my one government job. I was assistant to the director of the Mayor's Commission on Sexual Minorities, which for your younger listeners, before we were LGBTQ alphabet soup, we were sexual minorities. I've told, given that phrase to younger people, and they're like, was that about kink? I'm like, that's an interesting interpretation. It could have been, but no, it wasn't about that kind of sexual minority. So anyway, I worked with a lot of lawyers who serve. Now that's the Philadelphia Mayor's Advisory Council on LGBTQIA is how that has morphed. But I worked with great lawyers and saw that I don't want to do that. And I ended up in public health because the AIDS crisis was happening while I was in college. And because I came out as a lesbian and had many gay male friends. I was losing. It was the bad old days of AIDS, as we say. There were no good treatments, and I lost a lot of dear friends in the prime of their life. So it led me to work first in reproductive health, and then since 94, which is 30 years ago, I've been with the same organization in different roles, which is the Mid-Atlantic AIDS Education and Training Center, and we're a federally funded part of a national network training centers to make sure providers of healthcare have what they need to diagnose, treat, and prevent HIV. And I love my work. That's the day job. And I've had some broadcast things on the side where I met you guys.
That's right. I want you to go a little bit deeper into your healthcare role and also a little bit more in depth with the HIV treatment, hepatitis C, and other infectious diseases. You go a little bit more in depth in that work.
The organization I am based at is called the Health Federation of Philadelphia. We don't provide patient care. What we are is a coalition of community health centers. Like, they're all independent nonprofits, but we serve as a consortium of these federally funded safety net providers of healthcare, whether they can serve people, whether they can pay for it or not, or whether they're insured or not, or whether they're documented citizens or not. Community health centers are a great resource that many people don't know about. Health Federation also has a significant training and organizational development division. And that's where I work. One of the things I love about where I work is much of our work is behind the scenes, working on policy change that will have an impact on organizations and individuals. A lot of people don't know the work we do, and that's okay, because we know what we did behind the scenes to make change. So the examples you gave of the different disease states that I've worked on and continue to, both for provider education and policy issues, hepatitis C is a great example. It's the first virus we've ever been able to cure. The bad old days of HCV, the treatments were awful and toxic, had really bad side effects like depression and different things, and had at best 70% cure rate. So you'd be on these horrible meds for a year and you might not get cured. HIV research has led to a lot of other advancements. We learned in HIV research, COVID vaccines and treatment, they definitely led to the cure for hepatitis C. So once there was a cure, of course, everybody should have access to this. And HIV, when I said in the bad old days, we've seen that go from that was like a fatal disease to a treatable chronic disease. In fact, the physicians I work with say it's easier to treat somebody's HIV than their diabetes, because HIV is treated with medication. You take your medication as directed, and now there's injectables, so you only have to think about it every 2 months. You get virally suppressed, you're not going to get sick, and you can't transmit it to anyone else. But diabetes requires you to not only take medicine, but please stop eating the way you do. And behavior change is hard. Yeah, I have a lot of passion about the work I do. And part of it I feel so grateful for is I get to work with brilliant people. I'm not trained as a clinician. When the show we did on WYVE was canceled, I'm like, I think I'll go to grad school. And I got a master's in public health. And I did it while working full time. And I went once a month for 4 days to Columbia, which quite exhausting, but an amazing experience. And I got to experience New York. And I already knew this, but now I know for sure. I don't ever want to live there, but I love that I went to grad school for 2 years there. But I feel really fortunate because the clinicians I work with have taught me so much. I get to carry the good news about HIV and HCV. And
right,
maybe that's more than you needed, but like I said, I could go on.
How close do you think we are to a cure for HIV and AIDS? Because I've heard recently that might be something on the horizon.
That's the holy grail. And because it's a retrovirus, that means it takes over a cell in the body of someone who's infected and makes that cell, your T cell, an HIV production machine. And it has one of the highest, when viruses replicate, they make mistakes every time. And then you have selective resistance developed. We've learned about resistance through coronavirus, right? The virus is going to change as it mutates, and its job as a virus is to be as easily transmissible as possible. And coronavirus is actually a good example of now what's out there circulating. For most people, it's going to have a pretty low symptoms, right? They might just think, I have cold and allergies. They don't test anymore. So it's not making its host, on average, very sick, but it's really easy to transmit. And in fact, you're going to transmit coronavirus, and I'll come back to HIV in the parallel, before you even know. You might test yourself and you're not testing positive, but you are shedding virus. It's just not showing up on that rapid home test. But some people have a terrible outcome with coronavirus. With HIV, it replicates really rapidly, even more rapidly than, and it mutates more rapidly than the coronavirus. And because of that, a cure is next to impossible. The types of HIV are exponential because of the way it mutates so rapidly. And if people are on meds and missing doses, then you get special kinds of resistance that develop that are resistant against that medication. So if you hear people talk about medication-resistant gonorrhea, MRSA, HIV, if you either acquire a resistant virus because somebody had missed their meds, got a resistant virus, and then you acquired it from them, or if you are the one who had problems taking your meds as directed, you can end up with an HIV virus that doesn't respond to any of the meds. The conference on retroviruses just finished in Denver. It happens annually. CROI, the Conference on Opportunistic Infections and Retroviruses. And I just heard a presentation of what's in the pipeline. What's amazing is they're always developing new medications. I haven't heard an infectious disease doc in a long time say, I have a patient that has no medications left. It does happen in peds because not all the meds are approved for pediatric use. Because of the way it replicates and mutates so rapidly, I know people who've been working at companies like Merck for 20 plus years on either a vaccine or a complete cure, and it's not there. What we can do that we didn't used to be able to do, though, is shut down the replication in your body. And as long as you stay on those meds, if it's not replicating, it's not making you sick. It's not attacking your immune system. I don't know that in my lifetime that we'll see a cure or a vaccine. There'll have to be some enormous breakthrough because the current science is not able to.
What is amazing is to go from what we lived through in the 80s, the fear and death, the amount of people who died, and thinking that crisis was going to go on as it was when it started, to now watching TV commercials where people are managing it daily.
Or with injections. And we have prevention. That's PrEP, the pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV. So that either by an injection once every 2 months or a daily pill that has very low side effects profile, I could take that if I am in a relationship where I can't negotiate condoms, like my partner won't wear them, or I don't want to think about condoms. The other thing is there's a phrase that the CDC promotes, I don't think it's the best one, but it's U equals U, which means undetectable equals untransmittable, which are very multisyllabic words and not very low literacy. But the concept is if I'm on my meds and I'm undetectable, I can't transmit it. It's proven. We've done really clear research. And that's true. I can't transmit it through sharing drug paraphernalia and I can't transmit it sexually. It's helped a lot with the stigma because people with HIV still experience discrimination, stigma, and often shame. So yes, I completely agree with what you said, Renee, that the medication has been a game changer. And we call that PrEP biomedical prevention because before we had was behavioral prevention, which meant somebody had to negotiate either putting on a condom or asking someone to put on a condom. And that's hard, but taking a daily pill is a game changer.
It's like that behavior modification you were talking about earlier. It's really challenging to do. Close to impossible sometimes, depending on a situation that you're in.
Anybody that's ever tried to change the way they eat or quit smoking should have some compassion about how hard behavior changes.
You would hope that people would have compassion for others and empathy, but these days that seems to be hard to find.
Indeed.
I'm going to hard pivot right now. This year marks a huge milestone for your series, Amazon Country, your radio series. It's been 50, that's 50 years since the show first hit the airwaves on WXPN in Philadelphia. So congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
And since 1974, this show has been shining a spotlight on lesbian and feminist musicians. And you've been with the series since 1996 as host and producer. And what I'd like to know is, how did it all begin, the series, that is? And how has it stayed strong for 50 years? That is a huge achievement. So if you could tell us the origin story of Amazon Country on XPN.
It was founded by three women, a woman named Rose, and I don't know her last name, Roberta Hacker, who's still here in Philadelphia, and Victoria Brownworth, who's also still in Philadelphia. And people may know her name because she's an award-winning journalist. And I will be honest, this year I have committed to sit down and interview Roberta and Victoria together to get this origin story because I've had little pieces of it from Roberta because she's someone I'm in regular contact with. I don't know how they convinced XPN at University of Pennsylvania public radio station to start the show, but 74 was a lot of things started. There were women's music festivals happening and Olivia Records, which is a women-run record company that became Olivia Travel now, that's Women's Cruises, was starting. So it was this hotbed of lesbian feminism. And they began this weekly show that was lesbian feminist music and interviews. And I often say it's only on public radio that could happen and stay on the air for 50 years. A lot of things don't last 50 years. So there were many hosts over the years. When I moved to Philly for college in 82, I found it on the radio dial. And it was Lainey Goodman at the time, who just passed away in the last couple of years. She went on to do a show in Boston about women on the airwaves. I found this radio show on the air. And it was so cool for me because there were two women-focused radio shows, lesbian feminist focused radio shows in Pittsburgh that I had found. They were produced on WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech. It was Carnegie Mellon's college station. And when I was a baby dyke, it couldn't even say those words, yet identify myself that way. But around age 14, I had a major crush on a girlfriend and was having all these feelings. I found this radio show that was playing songs of love songs by women for women. And the two shows, it always makes me laugh. One was called Women Hold Up Half the Sky, and it was a feminist radio show. And the other one was called Woman to Woman, and it was a lesbian radio show. But they played the same artists, Holly Near and Farron and Margie Adam and Chris Williamson. So when I found a radio show like that on the airwaves in Philly, I was just so thrilled. So fast forward to the 90s, when I heard somebody say, oh, we're looking for a new host for this show. And I had met one of the hosts after Lainey, Elena Bouvier, who's a photographer. I always joked with her, like, how did a visual artist get to do radio? But we all ended up in odd places. I sent a fax. That's how long ago this was. And said, I'd like to apply for this job.
Faxes? What's a fax?
A facsimile. So then I followed up with a call to the station, and the receptionist said, oh, they filled that. I'm like, oh. So a while later, I don't know how long, months, Bob Bambera, and for people listening who know Philadelphia, he still does the news on the morning drive time on WXBN. He was the public affairs director. He called me and said, hey, do you still want this? And I was like, I thought it was filled. He said, oh, our temp receptionist always gave bad information. It was never filled. I'm like, okay. So I went in and convinced them that because I had performed like my poetry and singer-songwriter stuff, I could learn radio and I could do this. And Sue Pierce had been like the support person to Elena Bouvier, and she trained me, like totally unpaid. She basically volunteered to teach me radio, and I learned it on reel-to-reel, razor and tape, it's how you edit. So that's how it started, and I've been doing it since 96. I always make this joke that one of the young staffers at XPN heard I was having a 50th anniversary of the show, and they said, that's amazing. Did you found it? And I said, how old do you think I am? Because I was 10 in 74, but I wasn't that advanced at 10.
The littlest host of Amazon Country.
The lesbian. She really is a baby dyke.
Can you discuss the significance of WXPN in promoting diverse voices in music?
I absolutely can. In commercial radio, there used to be a rule that you couldn't play two women in a row, singers on the air, and there were like unwritten rules about how many you would play in an hour, as if the audience doesn't want to hear women. XPN never held to those conventions. And so, you know, they've had a live singer-songwriter festival they've done for years. It used to happen down at Penn's Landing. Now it happens in a beautiful waterfront park over in Camden.
Wiggins Park.
Exactly. They have always highlighted diverse voices that include lots of women. And I have great respect for that. And they've supported not just the show that I've hosted since 96, Amazon Country, lesbian feminist radio, but Amazon Country's always been followed by a gay radio show. It was called Sunshine Gay Dreams originally. Then it was just Gay Dreams. And now, under Robert Drake's hosting and producing, it's been called Q-Zine, like queer audio magazine, for many years. So we have had the support of the station that says, you know, these voices are important. And I am deeply grateful for that. And it's member-supported radio. So just like when we were colleagues at WYBE and we had to go directly to our viewers and ask them to pony up some membership dollars, that's how XBN is supported. The federal dollars from the Center for Public Broadcasting have gone up and down over the years. Every once in a while, some of the conservatives on you know, the Hill in DC will be like, why are we paying for this? So we can't depend on that being a steady funding stream. And we're really fortunate at XPN to have not only very loyal listeners who like they and their kids and then our grandkids listen, but we're always drawing in new listeners. And we're all about that highlighting independent musicians. Clearly, some of the musicians that start out independent end up being huge artists. Like we were one of the first to play Brandi Carlile and other artists, Sia. And my brain is blanking on names, but it's fun for me when I see artists who sent me like their first self-produced CD, you know, in 1999, and then they're at the Grammys. It's totally happened. And it's incredibly rewarding that we get to support the up and coming. Oh, I interviewed Mary Gaucher on the air when her first album was out, and it was called Dixie Kitchen. Because if you listen to her, she's a really good audiobook of her memoir. She was in the restaurant business and getting really burned out and started doing music. And that's why it was called that. I brought her into the studio at XPN and interviewed her and thought, well, she's great. She's going to go somewhere. She has. I've had some great experiences like that. And it's because that's the focus of XPN is to listen for those different voices and give them a platform.
What does this anniversary, this 50th anniversary mean for Amazon Country, for you personally, and for the LGBTQ plus community, and I guess the feminist community?
I think it shows the resilience of all of those communities that you mentioned, the lesbian feminists and feminists who aren't lesbians. You know, I end every show with, I'm Deborah D'Alessandro, reminding you, as I do every week, that lesbians and our allies are everywhere. Our allies are very important. And so it says that this show has remained supported all of these years, both by the station and by members, because you don't have to be a lesbian to enjoy my show. Talk about that on YBE. I hosted the show Philly Live, Your Lesbian Gay Connection. And I can remember vamping one of our fundraising nights. It's all live. And I like improvising and saying, if you don't have a lesbian in your life, I can be your personal lesbian. Give. So I think it's important that we have public broadcast, both on TV, which we did together, and on the radio airwaves, that makes, there's so much that is narrowcasted now. Broadcasting means anybody can find it and tune in. There it is. In Philly, it's 88.5 FM on the left side of your dial. All the good stuff is. It's very powerful to me that we remain publicly broadcasted. I think it's great that there's lots of narrowcasting. In fact, there's a podcast for anything you might want. I adore that you guys are choosing Podcetera. That means we're not going to have a narrow genre. Like, people aren't narrow. Most people. Yeah. So the long answer of that's what it means to me. And I also want to say that we haven't announced them yet, but we are in the works to have a number of activities this year, 2024, to celebrate and highlight Amazon Country's 50th anniversary. So keep your eye on xpn.org for things that'll be coming down the pike to celebrate it and celebrate
that resilience.
Because Lord knows in broadcast, there's a lot of things that don't last 50 years. I'm very proud to be a part of something that has.
That's fantastic. I remember before streaming, right? WXPN was a very niche audience, University of Pennsylvania radio station, college radio station. Now it's worldwide. So that's really incredible. You probably have listeners from all over the world. Now,
it's very rewarding. I was the first host to get the Amazon Country email address. My life spans the internet before and during. And that was the first big thing of people could email you. Because who writes a letter and puts a stamp on? Even then, that's a hard thing to do. I always say radio is talking to yourself in a padded room. So you don't know who's listening. You hope someone is. And I had like married women email me and say, I always remember this one. I used to be on from 9 to 10. I'm on at 11 p.m. now. My family doesn't understand why I go shopping so late on Sunday nights, but I'm really going so I can listen to your show in the car because I haven't come out yet. And hearing this has been so powerful. And I love hearing the events you announce because I know there's something out there. Because I've often said when I was 14, I was too young to go to a bar. I would have been afraid to even pick up a gay or lesbian newspaper if I happened to see one. And they weren't on people's corners in the 80s and the 70s at that time. So when I found those shows from Carnegie Mellon University as a teenager, I was having that same woman's experience. radio comes to you. It's very personal. And I'm very proud to continue that tradition on.
And it's connecting.
And you're talking to one person, because that's what I always learn. You don't know who's listening, but you assume someone is and you're talking to them. Those shows were on very late at night that RCT did. And I can remember my radio was right next to my bed. And I didn't have it up too loud because I didn't want my parents to know I was still awake. I mean, very intimate.
Did 14 or 18-year-old Deborah think she would ever be on the radio?
Yeah, I'll say this about that. When I came to Philly, I was like, wow, Temple has a college radio station. And I did want to do it, but you had to be an RCT radio, television, film, or whatever those letters are,
radio
major to be on WRCT. Whatever RTF. The radio station is. Thank you, RTF. My brain is.
I was a Temple grad.
In radio, television, film, RTF. Yeah. I wasn't that major. So I'm like, oh, I guess I'll never be on there. But I had a moment of hoping. That's why when this opportunity came up at XPN, it absolutely fulfilled something I had always been really interested in.
It was WRTI, right? Is that Temple's?
Temples,
and
yeah.
That was jazz, you know?
Mostly jazz, and, too, was, right?
That's right. It didn't have these kind of niche specialty shows, but I love jazz.
Hey,
I just wanted to try out radio.
Their loss.
But I do love Bob Perkins, who I think is still in the air. Just, I play good music, GM with BP. Do you know what I'm talking about? He's a wonderful broadcaster.
How has Amazon Country evolved since its inception in 1974, would you say?
I have to get back to you on after my conversation with Roberta and Victoria to know what their vision was when they started it. But I can tell you how it's evolved in the time I started listening to now. It's only a half hour now, which makes me sad. But there was a period right around the 30th anniversary when the leadership at the station was looking to cancel it. And I have to say, I was very moved that the community, I didn't organize them, but the community protested. It was back when they still had the singer-songwriter weekend at Penn's Landing, and this announcement came just before that. So you can imagine there were women with signs. My favorite was a sign by my friend Z, who is a big, beautiful woman, and her sign said, "It ain't over till the fat lady sings, and I ain't singing yet." Those were like hand-drawn signs. We kept it on the air, and it had to go down to half an hour. So that's one change. In the time that I've done it, I used to do more interviews. And also, I used to broadcast live. When I was on at 9 p.m., I followed Gene Shay's show. May he rest in peace. He did the folk show on XPN after many years at
Huge
HYY.
Huge broadcaster in Philly.
Yeah.
Yes. And he was the first friend that I lost to COVID. Because in April of 2020, he died of COVID at age 85. Gene Shay, amazing. And also, for anyone who's ever gone to the Philly Folk Festival, he was one of the founders and the longtime MC telling bad jokes on that stage. So it's now a half an hour and I don't produce it live because 11 p.m. on Sunday nights, like many of my listeners my age, and I will be 60 soon, sometimes I'm already asleep on Sundays at 11 p.m. So I pre-tape. So that's one change. I go in and tape a couple shows at a time. Because it's a half hour format, I kind of have to decide, am I going to have an interview or going to highlight music? Because I don't want to do any less than a 15-minute interview. I know that I'm going on as your guest now. As an interviewer, I ask very short questions. But if your guests, like me today, go on, it's hard to get much said in less than 20 minutes. So I don't do as many interviews. I'm selective about the interviews I do. The interviews I do are often authors. If there's a book that's really touched me, I interviewed Judy Shepherd, who's the mother of Matthew Shepherd. It's a hate crime many people are aware of. He was murdered in Laramie, Wyoming. And she wrote a beautiful memoir called The Meaning of Matthew. And that's an interview that I re-air on occasion because it's one that I'm most proud of. Alison Bechdel, when her Fun Home Broadway play was nominated for a Tony, I interviewed her. And that was a lot of fun. So I'm selective. And also, if there are artists coming to the Philly, our broadcast area, I try to do a phone interview in advance to help promote them. So I don't do as many interviews, but I'm hopefully still reaching folks who need to have either their minds opened with new information, new artists and authors, or be reminded that, hey, live music is going on. I really felt like post-COVID, it's really important that we continue to support live venues because we all got used to watching things streaming, but there's nothing like live performance in person, being with people in three dimensions. So I try to encourage folks to support local venues.
Do you have a memorable Amazon country moment?
I do. I have a good and bad. I'm going to name an author that was the rudest interview I ever had, and I don't think I'm going to lose anything. Eve Ensler, she was producing the Vagina Monologues here in Philly at Penn. And I'm like, that's great. Wow. So I produced live then. And I explained to her, as you guys will appreciate as producers, in advance, I talked to the guest and explained, this is live. So try not to have distractions. And where are you going to be when you're on the phone? I had made it very clear that we were live. You remember call waiting on a landline and you'd hear a click and it meant somebody was getting through. She answered a call waiting call while we were live on the air. I had to say, if you're just tuning in, that was Eve Ensler and we're going to go to some music now. So while the music's playing, she comes back and she apologizes. And I'm like, do you want to finish? Can you? Do you want? Yeah, you want to finish? Okay, good. We went back to the interview. She took another call. And then we ended it. So I don't understand what was going on for Eve. She never told me what. She didn't say she was having a family emergency and she wanted to continue it. But that was the weirdest interview, I have to say. And I think those two interviews that I still highlight are very memorable for me. Again, the intimacy of a phone call with Judy Shepard, who was willing to write a memoir about this incredibly devastating loss in her family. And I will say, when I worked with you all, like the celebrity who made me blush the most, and it was early in my time, was Martina Navratilova, who I somewhere in my attic, there's a VHS that hopefully hasn't been degraded by my attic, of that in other interviews. The interview that did that for me much later was Alison Bechdel, because for those of you who don't know who she is, she's a cartoonist who had a long-running serial cartoon called Dykes to Watch Out For that was like a soap opera of characters that continued from month to month. It was a monthly, and it was in lesbian publications. And it was like the story of our lives reflected in a comic strip. And it was both funny, and there was a lot of political commentary. So she's written now two graphic memoirs, one of which became the Broadway musical Fun Home, because her parents ran a funeral home that her and her siblings called the Fun Home, which is why it's named that. To interview her, I was very proud because she'd done a lot of press because it was a Tony award-winning, at that point it was just nominated, but it won a Tony, more than one. So she'd done a lot of mainstream press. I think was the only interview she'd had in that tour that knew her original work and asked her things like, was Clarice really representing your partner? When we all know you were Mo in the cartoon, Clarice seemed a lot like this character in the play. And she's, this is amazing. You really know my work. So that was probably one of the most fun. She did remember having met me a million years ago in Burlington, Vermont, because she was at a potluck that I was at, because that's cool. How the lesbian community works. Burlington's, but so big.
Very cool.
Just in case people are offended by the word dyke, I use that term because it's in community. Older lesbians hate that because it was thrown at them as an epithet, and I respect that. But the same way that some members of the Black community don't like the N-word that gets used both kind of culturally and familiarly, that's a word that I get to use. I find it an empowering word, and most non-lesbian people don't use it the same way that I don't use the N-word. Because in my generation, as I said, I came out in the 80s, we were reclaiming that word. What that word means is a strong lesbian, like Amazon, which is where that word comes from, why the show was named that. Amazons are strong, mythical warriors. And there you go. I want to just give some apology.
I can't use that word.
Yeah, but I can.
Yes. So it's good that you have a diverse
two host. Two to one.
There we go.
You guys, you use it all day long.
See? How's it feel being a minority, Renee?
I have no problem with that.
I'm kidding.
I never have.
I know. I'm just kidding. All right.
Thank you for that. Actually, should have been a question up front. Where did the name come from? But
well, what's funny is it was long before there was Amazon.com. And I don't know if there was an Amazon bookstore in Minneapolis that had to sue Amazon Books because Amazon.com was originally just a bookseller. I don't think it was successful. I think the big money lawyers won that. And it, as we know, independent bookstores have been put out of business by Amazon, regardless of what they're named. But yes, my show predates the internet. Of course, it predates Amazon.com. And if you Google Amazon Music, you'll just get like Amazon.com Music. But if you put Amazon XPN, you'll find me.
We can put in the show notes everything that Deborah links. Predates.
I like to call myself a mid-century modern original. I was born in 64, where that crappy veneer furniture young hipsters think are so cool. Mid-century modern. Yeah. When people said that was a cool thing, I'm like, that's crap my grandma had? My God, why do you want that?
Can you discuss the importance of highlighting lesbian and feminist musicians?
I think some people might wonder why there needs to be a show like Amazon Crunchy, because it's not a career killer to be out anymore, but that was not the case. I can remember when we watched, I was living in a house with other women and we were watching the Grammys together because Melissa Etheridge was on and she was nominated as like best new artist. And she came in full like leather and sang one of the songs from that self-titled album. And we were like, she's such a lesbian. How does she not shave? And she had performed at women's festivals. She performed at the Southern Women's Music and Comedy Festival. So she did come out later. She didn't put out this energy the way Melissa did. Janice Ian came out with an album called Breaking Silence. It was very, if you read her memoir, it was a lot of thought put into coming out because that was in the 90s. I'm bad on timelines, but whenever it was still dangerous to your career. And so the fact that Amazon Country has always highlighted out lesbian artists and other women feminist artists is because they were never going to get airplay when this show started. And even when I took on in 96, it was still a big deal and a big choice to say, geez, am I going to change? Am I either going to not use no pronouns? Like think of Tracy Chapman for My Lover. Like we were all like, oh, that's amazing. There's no pronouns in that song. She's out now, but she wasn't then. So yes, we were giving a platform for people who were brave enough to be out at a time when mainstream music was not going to air them if they went there.
That's right. And college radio was a platform for that too.
Always edgier. They were the ones playing punk before that was acceptable on the radio.
Right.
I love college radio. When I travel, I like to find what's on the left side of the dial when you're on a road trip. All the good stuff is over there.
All the 90s grunge bands, all that started on college radio too.
Absolutely.
We've gone from Melissa Etheridge to this year, Tracy Chapman returning with her appearance on the Grammys, fully out, right? What are your thoughts on the current state of representation in music now?
I think it's amazing. Brandi Carlile has been a real lesbian music icon, and it just is who she is. That's the thing is, she didn't make a decision. She was already out when she began performing. She's got another great memoir. She never made a decision to be closeted. I can't remember how old she is. She's a lot younger than me. I mean, she's in her 30s. I think the trailblazers who paved the way, and not just the things that changed in the world. So getting rid of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed by Bill Clinton. This is my moment of politics. Look, many of us have been disappointed by many Democrats, but look at the alternative. That's what I'll say about that. So we've changed the policies that allowed my wife and I, Carol Brown, have been together since 1993, but we couldn't be legally married until 2013. We were 20 years together. So as all that changed, it made it safer for folks to be out in music. So I think that the state of our lesbian union is strong. The state of the world now, it's always under threat. Depends on where you live, you know, like Texas, Florida. Been interesting to watch the legislation about the don't ask, well, they don't call it don't ask, don't tell, the don't say gay in Florida. The idea that a lesbian or gay teacher could be fired for having a picture of they and their partner, they just, we've been here before. You guys aren't old enough to remember Anita Bryant.
I remember it.
So
I was very young, but I remember.
And her campaign against the gays. J.D. Doyle has an amazing website called Queer Musical Heritage. And he has a website of all kinds of queer music and a photo gallery of album covers. So the theme song for Amazon Country is called Leaping Lesbians. And it is from a compilation album put out by Olivia Records called Lesbian Concentrate. And the reason there is an orange juice concentrate can on the cover of that album is a reference to Anita Bryant. She was a Christian singer and a former Miss America pageant contestant. I don't know if she won, who was the spokesperson for Florida Orange Juice. And she had a slogan on the commercial, a day without orange juice. It's like a day without sunshine. She became the spokesperson for a Florida law to make it illegal for public school teachers to be hired if they were homosexual. And so Lesbian Concentrate, there's songs on that album that are directly speaking to her. Linda Tillery, who's an amazing African-American musician, has a song called Sister Nita that's directly talking to her. So we've been here before. That was in the 70s. That album came out around 77. And the same way that the Black Civil Rights Movement is saying all of this voter suppression, we have been here before. What's the line? History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. So people need to pay attention, because the state of being out and proud and safe is true in some places and not others. And I'm grateful to live in my purple state of Pennsylvania, in a very affirming city of Philadelphia. So
how do you curate the music selection for Amazon Country, and what criteria do you use to feature artists?
Well, it's interesting. I feel like I don't get as much new music because artists used to send me CDs. So now I get inundated with emails that say, do you want me to send you a link? I'm just old school enough. I will preview music digitally, but if I really like it, I will ask for the CD, partly because I like to read liner notes. That's who I am. And I have a car that has a CD player. I have a CD player at home, but
Deborah's old school.
I am old school. You know what? The Subaru I just bought, and of course it's a Subaru, they've always been lesbian supportive.
Thanks, Martina.
Is a 2019 Subaru Ascent, and it's the last year they put CD players in the car. And I'm like, it barely is my last car. I can't imagine not having it. Obviously, I know how to connect my phone to the car, and I have a lot of songs in my playlist, but I like CDs. So how do I curate? I listen for production quality, because sometimes people are sending you things that they've self-produced and it's not radio ready. And I have given feedback about that. And I've gotten to see artists improve over the years, because Chris Matthews is an example of an artist who's just exponentially improved over the years. She sent me one of her first, and I was like, I can't play this on the air. I'm sorry. But now I do play her. She has high quality and she's living in Nashville and getting ready to produce her first Nashville album. So I listen for, is it radio ready? And then I'm interested in all genres. I probably play a lot of folky style because that's a lot of what I'm sent, but I love artists of all genres and I listen for what grabs me. I mean, the thing about being a DJ is you get to be subjective. And yeah, so that's how I curate.
What do you hope listeners take away from each episode of the show, and any anecdotes or stories through the years? I think you maybe touched on that.
What I hope they take away is feeling uplifted by the music. I think about the time of night, like 11 to 11:30. Music has such power to impact our mood, right? If I aired at a different time of day, I might play more raucous. I do tend towards the, especially in the last quadrant of the show, the third half, as the car guys would have said, quieter, soothing music. And I also hope that when I have interviews, that they learn something, perhaps they didn't know, or they learn about an artist or an author that they're interested in. That's what I'm hoping to impart before I record. I think about that intimacy that I described I experienced as a listener when I discovered lesbian and feminist radio on the airwaves as a teen, that I'm talking to one person. And they might have me on earbuds. So I want to have a positive experience. If you're feeling alone, there's, wow, there's somebody that's talking to me now. They're sharing music with me. I think of it as a positive, quiet, intimate listening experience.
I know you're celebrating this 50th anniversary, but are you looking ahead to the future? Any future plans or goals? How long do you want to host?
As long as it's still fun and I'm still having fun. I don't have any retirement plans for the show. I only want to work in my day job another 10 years. So we'll see. If I'm retiring from my job at 70, you know, are we going to buy an RV and travel the country? I don't know. That's one of the things we think about. But now we could record this from anywhere because everything's changed, right? You guys are in two different cities doing a podcast. I don't have a strategic long-term plan for Amazon Country. I have a new person I report to at the station who has been saying, we need to have some conversations, like in a positive way. So I think with somebody else guiding me, maybe I would. But every week I go in and I'm like, what music do I want to play? And I make it topical and seasonal and who's coming to town. And it's fresh every time for me. And I like it that way. But you ask a question, Renee, that makes me think maybe I should have some plans other than how we're going to celebrate the 50th. But I don't.
How do you think Amazon Country has impacted your life?
In really positive ways. It's given me a platform to highlight artists, both the music and the artists and authors that I've interviewed. It probably gave me an in when I auditioned for YBE television host because I had broadcast experience. I jokingly say that for a while I felt like the lesbian spokesmodel of Philadelphia. For people that remember the spokesmodel phrase out of, what was that show Ed McMahon did? Wasn't it on there? So it's given me my 15 minutes of fame have ticked away, to reference Andy Warhol. It's given me other opportunities. I emcee women's music festivals. I still do Sister Space Weekend, which happens in Darlington, Maryland, every weekend after Labor Day. So every September, they call me their MC for life. I get to do a little stand up and keep the show rolling. And I've also been able to meet artists. I become friends with Farron, which if people don't know her, is an amazing artist. I think of her as my big sis. She lived in Philly for a while. So I interviewed her when she lived here and then turned out she lived around the corner from me in Mount Airy. We became friends. It's given me amazing opportunities. I'm very grateful for that.
As we come to the end of the interview, could you let our listeners know how they can learn more about Amazon Country and about you as well?
I have a Facebook presence because I'm old and I like Facebook. I'm also on the Instagram and on the Twitter that is now X. So I'm not a high user of X, but I've kept the handle Deborah Zon, which I love. So Deborah with Z-O-N on the end, like Amazon. Amazon Country Lesbian Feminist Radio is where you can find the page on Facebook. And I'm also Deborah Zon on Instagram. If you go to xpn.org and go to schedule, you can find Amazon Country there. And if you want to be in touch with me, I would say that messaging me on Insta or Facebook would be the way to do that. I also do music, which we don't have time to talk about, but the band I sing in is Roadshow Relics, and we play all around Philly. We just sold out a really fun venue in Ardmore, and we're doing more and more originals. We did an hour and a half set with three covers, and the rest are all originals written by various band members, including me. So those are the ways to find me.
Awesome. Great. So now we're going to go to our speed round. We call it a speed round, but some aren't speedy. Get to know you questions. The first one is, who was your childhood crush?
Martina Navratilova.
Oh, really?
And when I was in elementary school, it was a girl named Chrissy. I pined for her and I didn't know why. I really wanted her to come over. And yeah, those were the two.
Wow. I didn't know that.
That's why I turned Five Shades of Red.
No, I guess so.
You should have told us. That would have been interesting to know.
No, that would be
before
more
that
embarrassing to tell you.
Years later,
I tried to keep it together.
We found out.
I tried to keep it together. I wanted to be a professional.
Deborah's sitting there. Keep it together. Keep it together. Keep it together.
We find out 30 years later.
Hopefully, I did keep it together. You didn't know.
That's right. Smooth. What is your favorite lyric from a song?
Now, that's hard. This isn't a song anybody knows. I sing in a group called Threshold Choir. We sing in small trios a cappella at the bedside of hospice patients. I'm going to sing it for you. In the end, what matters most is how well did I live? How well did I love? How well did I learn to let go? I love that text, and I use it as a mantra sometimes.
Wow.
It's beautiful.
Nice.
Thank you.
Here's another pivot. What's your Dance Like No One's Watching song or go-to karaoke song?
XPN had a holiday party with karaoke, and I did this because it was the first karaoke song I ever did in 1987, and it's still my favorite. Midnight Train to Georgia, Gladys Knight and the Pips. And my Dance Like No One's Watching is that entire album by Melissa Etheridge, that first album.
That is a great album.
It is. It kind of veers very closely to stalking, come to my window and things, but it's still great to dance to.
If you could fix one thing about our healthcare system today with a snap of your fingers, what would you fix?
Universal health insurance, government funded for everybody. No private healthcare insurance. Take capitalism out of healthcare. It's not a for-profit entity. It should be treated like any other public utility, like water and electricity, which of course now some of those are for-profit. There are some things that are a social good, and people's healthcare is one of them.
Well said.
Hear, hear, multiple snaps. What is the funniest moment you've ever shared with a stranger?
I talk to strangers all the time and I laugh easily. Here's one. I was on a regional rail train from Center City to my Germantown home, and the train was stopped and it was very crowded and we were all grumpy. And there was a beautiful little girl, 5 years old, who was like in a good mood, right? And she didn't know, why is everybody so grumpy? And she said, I have good employees. And she was shaking the box and I started singing the theme song and everybody joined me. Jew Charlie, and everybody, because people of a certain age know that song. She looked like something magical had happened because people were singing songs she had never heard. And then we were all happy. And then this train was stopped. So that's my favorite thing.
That's awesome.
Love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really rings a bell.
Do you live by any words of wisdom?
How important is it as a litmus test when you're getting really upset about something? Because sometimes it's not that important. How important is it? I also have one that a mentor gave me. Can you live with the headline? Like if you're as an organization making a decision that's, can you live with the headline? Could it be misinterpreted? And this was before the whole era of the internet. So she gave great advice, right? Because now something can become a headline like faster than it used to. Can we live with the headline? That's the other one on a professional level.
That is a good one. Really good one. Each episode, we do a segment called Question Down the Lane. We ask our guests to provide a question for the next guest. So our last guest has provided a question for you. What creative achievement are you most proud of?
Songwriting. And the song I'm most proud of is called 16 Forever. In 2011, I lost my 16-year-old nephew to suicide. And so keeping his memory alive when I sing that song, and they hear a little bit about Christopher, is what I'm most proud of.
Deborah, thank you for a great conversation. Again, congratulations on Amazon Country. And it was great talking to you again and connecting. Thank you for joining us on Podcetera. Be sure to tune in to Amazon Country every Sunday at 11 p.m. Eastern on WXPM Philadelphia. You can find that online at wxpn.org/program/Amazon-Country.
And if you can't remember that, just go to the thing that says programs and click on Amazon Country. There's a way to contact me there as well.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you, Deborah. Pleasure.
I want to thank both of you for founding this podcast. It's the best name ever, Podcetera, and for inviting me to be part of it. It's been great to reconnect after way too many years. The pleasure is all mine. It was delightful to have this conversation, and I wish all the best in your future with Podcetera. Thanks for having me.
I was wondering if you could sing us out of the episode.
That would be very meaningful for me in honor of my nephew, Christopher Wheeler. 16 Forever.
Horses, then beggars would ride. If wishes could come true, you'd be by my side. My sweet boy of 16 with eyes just like mine. You hid all your sorrow inside. If regrets were raindrops, I'd be carried away on the flood of all I didn't do, didn't say. Didn't know how you suffered as I have myself, with our common inheritance of our own private hell. you didn't believe it would get better. Now you're frozen at 16 forever. Think of you each and every day. Now it's been years since you went away. When you decided it was your life to take, and you made an irreversible mistake. 'Cause you didn't believe it would get better. Now you're frozen at 16. Grief is my companion now, a never-ending, uninvited guest, with its constant whispering in my ear, what if, what if, what if. Wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. If wishes could come true, you'd be by my side. My sweet boy of 16 with eyes just like mine, the end of our family line. 'Cause you didn't believe it would get better.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and share Podcetera. And be sure to follow and like the series wherever you enjoy podcasts.
For Podcetera, I'm Renee Lego.
And I'm Joelle Ludovic. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.